Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian Rowan, and as always, I'm joined by Danny King, writer for The Film Stage, and Nick Newman, the associate editor of The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hey.
For anyone just joining us, what we usually do is discuss one topic that is going on in the world of film at the time. From there, we will launch into a feature review, which this week will be Sleepless Night, a French thriller that premiered at Tribeca and is available on video on demand and iTunes now. And then after we give our brief impressions of that, we will move into a spoiler section, and then we will give our look forward to the week ahead in movies to give you what we think are our best bets. So what we wanted to talk about this week is the kind of strange uproar that came out of CinemaCon. For anyone who's not familiar, CinemaCon is a yearly meeting of the National Association of Theater Owners. It's attended by different management types from all theater chains across the United States, as well as a number of film journalists, because they premiere special footage of upcoming films, and they also use it as a platform to showcase kind of new advances in movie projection technology and just cinema technology in general. The big ruckus that came out this past week was the discussion over the 10 minutes of footage shown of Peter Jackson's upcoming Hobbit film, which for a first time in movie history was shot and presented in 48 frames per second, which means that an average film, every second of footage is comprised of 24 frames shown in rapid succession, whereas this film was shown in 48 frames. So what we want to do is talk about the reaction to that, which was at first absolutely negative and has now become decidedly more mixed. And then from there, we'll move on to just kind of how this bleeds into the greater discussion of technology in filmmaking and film presentation in general. So, Nick, let's start with you. What did you hear about this? What were the reactions that you first started seeing? And what was your reaction to the reactions? And do you have a specific viewpoint on this as it stands? We'll keep it to 48 frames per second for now, and then we'll jump into discussion of greater technologies in general.
Well, the reactions I heard were predominantly negative. Most people were saying that it looked like an episode of a British TV show, which I think anybody who has actually seen an episode of a British TV show knows exactly what they mean, and that's not necessarily good. And one of the big complaints I heard was that when it came to this Hobbit footage is that it lost the filmic qualities that were present in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. There wasn't much of a heft to it. It all felt kind of lightweight and artificial. And my reaction to that reaction was disappointment, because I'm looking forward to The Hobbit very much. And one of the reasons I'm excited is because I want to return to the world of Middle Earth. So when I heard this news, I kind of let out this sigh, because I realized that maybe what Peter Jackson and James Cameron have been touting for, I guess, a year now is not the bee's knees, as was once indicated. But when it comes to the actual technology, it's a little hard for me to completely speak out on it, because I haven't actually seen a 48 frames presentation. But from what I understand, it's not even a new technology. It's actually something that's been around for a long time. It's just that people like Cameron and Jackson are now embracing it. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe they were misguided this whole time.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's definitely not a new technology. I mean, technically, whenever they used to film films in slow motion, they just ran the film through the camera faster and then slowed it back down to 24 frames per second. You do bring up the point that it's being pushed by these two heavyweights in the industry, and that's kind of creating a momentum, almost artificially, towards this that most people aren't sure they're ready to embrace. Danny, what were your thoughts on this when you first started hearing about this reaction?
Well, one of the things I found ironic, which what Nick mentioned briefly, is that people are complaining that it's ruining this filmic quality for these epic Lord of the Rings type movies. And yet Jackson and Cameron, the like true champions of this technology, those are the only movies they want to make. And it seems like it's actually ruining those movies more specifically than other ones, which is kind of interesting. But this 48 frames movement in general, just from what I've read, seems like it has the potential to be much bigger than a lot of these other mini digital leaps that have been happening. So I think if there's anything to take from it, and this is Peter Jackson mentioned this briefly in his kind of official press response, but It's that we really should be patient with this particular movement just because it has the potential to be so widespread and influential and could like potentially change these fantasy genres entirely.
Yeah, my thing that I first heard, I read the basic initial first official response from a journalist, and that was on the Badass Digest, and that was Devin's response to it. And he used the analogy that it seemed like one of those poorly calibrated TVs at Best Buy, mm-hmm. which is sort of what my greatest fear was going to be. Every time I walk into a Best Buy and I see a film playing on one of those televisions, it looks crisp and it looks fluid, but there's kind of this weird flatness to it, and I always wondered what the heck was going on with those televisions. Now apparently what I've learned is that those TVs are using kind of a bastardized version of this. They interpolate what should be happening between certain frames in order to make it happen in a manner similar to 48 frames per second, and that's what gives it that weird British television slash soap opera look. And to me, I understand the push towards new technologies in film. Obviously, you know, the move towards motion capture and legitimizing that as a performance art, that kind of makes sense to me because it does help with the narrative. You couldn't have had, I didn't have the, you know, emotional reaction, but a lot of people had the emotional reaction in Rise of the Planet of the Apes because of that. And that's something that could only be achieved through that technology. My major takeaway from what I've been reading about 48 frames per second is that it has no real purpose in a story way. I've heard the landscapes look great, but that once you actually start getting into the action, it just looks weird and the sets look like sets. And I don't think that that's something that we should have to accept for however long it takes us to get used to it. Am I the only person who feels that way?
No, I agree. I mean, you could also say the same thing about 3D, how it doesn't contribute to the story, but I think that there's at least a certain aesthetic appeal and a certain aesthetic purpose if you're talking about specific kinds of films with 3D. You know, if you have like a funhouse movie where things are popping out of the screen, or even in like Hugo, which kind of use the technology as a way of kind of commenting upon the technology that Méliès was using in his early films. But with 48 frames per second, I don't know why a certain lifelike quality is going to completely aid the film itself. I mean, does anybody have a problem with the way 24 frames look, realistically?
Yeah, no, I definitely do not. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. The whole, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, a good Blu-ray looks as lifelike as I would necessarily want. Like, you go into a Best Buy and you see those TVs, and it looks, there's a certain clarity to it, but at the same time, in the back of your head, you're thinking, what the hell is going on here? That's not how a movie is supposed to look.
Exactly.
It's not supposed to move that fast and be that bright. So I think that it doesn't really make sense why they're pushing this forward, because I don't know why movies don't just look fine the way they are. And I know you could have said that 10 years ago when you only had DVDs and there were no Blu-rays and HD was not a big thing in the market. But at this point, I think we're good. I don't know why things need to be pushed that extra step.
And that's what I was saying about the kind of artificial momentum that's being built up. These directors, Jackson and Cameron in particular, seem to have found a problem that doesn't exist, and they're rushing as fast as they can to fix it, and I don't know why. And it kind of annoys me that they're like, you'll get used to it, because it doesn't, they're not really justifying in terms of art, they're justifying it in terms of technology. Like, hey guys, this is the future, like, just get used to it. But I don't feel it's necessary. And that kind of, you know, ties in with this whole push towards digital projection and digital filming as well. There's been a lot of talk recently about the fact that 35mm is basically being phased out. Traditional projections going by the wayside. They're not really making prints of films anymore in 35mm. And again, it's one of these things where I'm sure that for the companies, it makes a lot of sense. For the studios, it makes a lot of sense to cut out all of this extra production cost and just send out a disc rather than, you know, canisters of film that have to be shipped in a special way and, you know, have to be reprinted after a couple of showings, a couple, I should say, more like 100 or so. But it just doesn't, it seems as though we're rushing forward so quickly that we're not taking time to actually look at the tracks we're making. There's been a lot of talk about how digital technologies will actually make it more expensive to preserve films and more difficult. And I don't know why this is happening or where it's coming from. it just seems to be technology for the sake of technology. Like, we've become so enamored with the next big thing that we don't stop to think that it might be worse than what we already have.
I kind of want to just throw in, and this ties a little bit into the general conversation we're going to have, but there's this Entertainment Weekly article about The Hobbit, and the last line of it is, The Hobbit will be available in 6 different ways, 3D, 2D, IMAX 3D, 24 frames, 48 frames. And it's just like, I don't want to, when a movie comes out in theaters, I don't want to have to pick from between 6 different formats.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of how to see it. It just strikes, like, it's enough of kind of a task when, like, I'll see The Lord of the Rings in theaters, and then friends of mine will be like, oh, you haven't seen it until you've seen the extended edition. So I'll watch those, which are like 11 hours. And then now it's like, I'll see it in 48 frames, and I'll read someone who says, oh, you haven't seen it until you've seen it in 3D IMAX, or actually it's best in 2D. It just feels like these digital advances are just making the process of movie making so much more, I don't know, kind of stressful than it maybe needs to be, and more complicated than it needs to be.
I was going to say how one of the problems I have with this is that I'm actually looking forward to The Hobbit as a movie. I'm looking forward to seeing it and seeing Tolkien's book come to life and going back to that world. So I don't want this movie to just become a technical discussion, and I don't want it to just be something where you have to, you know, compare different versions of it. I mean, it's even like when you talk about the extended editions of Lord of the Rings, I feel like, you know, that's sort of been pushed forward more than the theatrical cuts as they were. So it's not like there's a huge difference between, rather I should say, it's not like there's a huge choice that you have to make when you're talking about those films, but now it's like, yeah, there's 6 different versions of the movie. It's like, can I just enjoy the film as it is? Do I have to go through the selection process like I'm grocery shopping or something?
Yeah, no, and it's funny because I think, you know, most of us would agree that we view films as an art form. Obviously, it's entertainment. Obviously, it's a product, but it's also art. And this discussion that's been going on about not only 48 frames per second, but digital versus film. I mean, if you think about it, it's close to the same thing as saying, you know, you don't need to see the Mona Lisa in person because we have a good enough screen that it can perfectly replicate it. There's something missing. There's a warmth and humanity when you just digitize things and then reduce them, like you said, away from being an adaptation of something you love or like a way to escape to a new place and just say, ooh, technology. You know, you can cover it in tinfoil all you want, but it doesn't make sense to me that you're trying to glitz it up in a way that seems completely unnecessary, especially if you're trying to use it as a selling point. Because I feel like, you know, Jackson-directed prequel to Lord of the Rings is really all of the words you need to get this thing into theaters and make a lot of money. The other thing I wanted to talk about was, there was, in one of these articles, there have been a slew of them, so forgive me for not remembering. I'll try to include it in the show notes when I can find it. Someone had said that the reason for all of these different technologies, the 3D, the IMAX, the 48 frames per second, the laser projection, was because they were trying to fight the home video market, and they were trying to, I think the term they used was, widen the gulf of experience between watching something at home and watching something in the movie theaters. At the same time, certain chains are flirting with the idea of allowing texting in a movie theater, which to me says that these people don't grasp the reason that many people go to movies. Am I wrong in thinking that if you were to eliminate some of the lesser concerns that people have, you know, texting, talking, things like that, and just get back to this idea that movies should be made with some sense of quality? I mean, we look at things like the Transformers and Battleship, and sure, they make a lot of money, but they're not especially filmic. They're not something that you feel like you have to go to the theater to see. I mean, no one was looking at me in the eyes and telling me that I had to see Transformers in the theater. But there have been films where people have said, if you don't see this in the theater, you're doing yourself a disservice. So wouldn't it be better to try to push an atmosphere in an actual tactile sense, you know, a place of kind of, you know, odd reverence of the film form itself, than to just try to glitz it up with new and expensive ways of projecting it?
Well, wouldn't that require too much work on the theaters' parts?
Or? I mean, it might require more work, but it wouldn't require quite as much money as they're already pouring into
it. Well, the problem is that it would require any work, which is a struggle for theater chains. So, you know.
I guess the other question there is it worth continuing to fight the home video market?
I think that fight is kind of the people who are anti-watching movies on laptops and TVs. I feel like they're almost, like we talked about earlier, they're making a fight where there doesn't deserve to be one, because if you want to watch movies, the number one thing is to just watch them. It's not like you have to watch them in the absolute perfect environment or else you're not really seeing the movie. I feel like that's just a really narrow viewpoint to have. I'm not going to watch a movie on demand and then talk about it with someone who saw it in a theater and pretend like we had completely different experiences where I can't even talk about it with him on the same wavelength. You know, like, I feel like obviously the theater is ideal, but I don't feel like there's a reason to have a negative connotation associated with home video or whatnot.
I mean, the movie we're reviewing this week, I watched on my computer.
Legally, of course, but
yeah, the last 2 weeks, I've had to watch the movie we're discussing on my computer. And again, I don't feel like that's a bad thing. So like I was saying, the kind of battle against the home video market from the perspective of Hollywood and the theater owners, it's one of these things where not only is the technology changing, but the business model's changing. And I don't know that there's a clean way to just dissever all of these different connotations that people have. I guess we'll know for certain when The Hobbit debuts this winter exactly how well 48 frames per second actually does take hold. I'm sure that they'll be eagerly counting what kind of tickets were sold to which thing. They're already doing that for 3D film releases. So I guess we can look forward to the six-tiered pricing structure that will go into giving us The Hobbit this winter. So yeah, I mean, now that we've kind of dissected that in a very broad sense, does anyone have any final thoughts on the idea of movie technology moving forward? Is anyone going to particularly miss, you know, 35 millimeter and just the various ways that we've kind of gotten used to movies? If 24 frames per second goes the wayside, is anyone going to have a visceral reaction to that?
I'll miss 35 millimeter.
Yes, I will miss it very much.
All right, good. Because I get worried, because I tell some people this, and obviously they don't quite understand what I'm talking about, because I feel like, especially when we get down to things like frame rates, a lot of people in the general public don't quite get where I'm coming from. So I'm glad to hear that. I know that I will particularly miss 35 millimeter. I still prefer to shoot my photographs with film because there's just, and this is one of those things that people just don't understand. It's the same reason that I also like to buy vinyl records. There's a warmth and an almost imperfect magic to it. It lets you know that something that's been crafted rather than something that's just been duplicated. And I don't know what your reasons for missing 35 millimeter would be, but
basically the same.
Mine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know I took a photography class my senior year in high school, and I remember the first print I developed, I just looked at it and I was like, why did I ever use a digital camera in my life? This just looks so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never heard somebody argue against 35 millimeter who sounds like they truly appreciate film. Like, I know that sounds like broad and maybe a little brash, but I mean it sincerely. I've never heard somebody argue against the format, and I don't, when they argue against that, I don't think, well, yeah, I can trust their opinion on film as a medium, because I think there's an inherent misunderstanding going on where people are saying, oh, but digital's so much clearer, when in fact, I think that 35 millimeter presents a deeper image. It has more depth, you know?
Yeah, there's something that came up. I was talking with a friend yesterday about the Public Enemies, the Michael Mann film with Johnny Depp. And as much as I like that film, I mean, the use of digital photography was a pretty huge misstep, I feel. There's just, you're right, there's something about 35 millimeter that just speaks to that, you know, that old, almost like preternatural part of you that just appreciates a film and looks at it and understands what it's doing. And it's kind of sad that, you know, there are some people who don't understand that or don't grasp this almost existential feeling you get from it, and all that they can see is that something new's come out and new is better. But this is the world we live
just
in.
Just to really quick say something good about new is that I would say IMAX is probably the best format, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that.
For immersion plus...
But that's 70 millimeter.
Right, yeah, no, that's even absolutely. More millimeters.
I'm just saying, like, in terms of, like...
oh, no, definitely.
Like, new things that have been created, I would say... Like, that's one that I am behind.
Yeah. When I saw Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol,
Right.
I immediately said, you know, forget 3D, IMAX. If you're going to invest in any technology, for God's sakes, invest in IMAX, because that is especially something that, unless you're obscenely wealthy, you're not going to be able to recreate that experience at home. Like, when you talk about an experience gulf or a gulf of experience, like, you know, I can continue to get larger and larger TVs and sit there and, you know, have my friend texting next to me to make it feel like a movie theater. But it would take something extreme to make it feel like an IMAX theater. And I'm afraid of heights, and Mission Impossible terrified me. So,
yeah, me too.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that you can only get in theater. And I'm one of those people who said, you know, to a friend who only saw it, you know, on a home video screen, I was like, you should have gone and seen it in IMAX. It was incredible.
Yeah. Even The Dark Knight, I remember, like, being afraid of heights, like the overhead shots of the city. It was like, whoa. Yeah.
Well, we will see what happens. I'm sure that when we eventually do review The Hobbit, I know I'm going to try to see it in 48 frames per second just because I'm curious about it now. And I'm worried that that's going to falsely inflate profits that will make them think it's a good idea. But I'm going to do it anyway. So I guess we'll see then what everyone saw at CinemaCon. Now that we're out of the woods on that discussion, I think it's time to move into our feature review of the thriller Sleepless Night.
When the deal went down, they didn't know whose side he was on.
C'est tout?
Ouais, c'est dans le lieu sûr.
C'est qui lui?
Parce que je suis flic. Oh, ça va, je suis flic, mais je fais du business.
J'aimerais récupérer le sac.
C'est quoi ce bordel, ouais, Thomas?
When they took his son, he became a desperate father. And when his partners double-crossed him,
bon ben vous le retrouvez et vous le lâchez plus.
They turned him into a dangerous man.
And that was a clip from the trailer for Sleepless Night. The plot of this film, in a very basic sense, involves a drug heist that goes wrong and a man trying to get his son back following the fallout of this drug heist. And it takes place in a single night, obviously. And it's primarily set in a really nice looking nightclub. It was directed by Frederick Jardine. So yeah, we'll start off with our initial impressions of this film, broad outline, whether we liked it or not, and then once we've kind of exhausted that, we will go into the spoilers. Danny, let's start with you. What were your thoughts on Sleepless Night?
I thought it was very good action film. I thought the camera work was consistently energetic and immersive and kind of distinctive in a way that a lot of other films in this style can't really say. And like you said, it's mostly set in this one club. And maybe the greatest pleasure of the film is just how much damage is done to this location over the course of the night. It just keeps snowballing. And in addition to that, it remains believable mostly, which is also a good quality. I think that there is something with these real-time stories that makes it difficult to have a really true emotional attachment, just because the characterizations are so temporally limited. I know a lot of people that really, really love this movie mention like the father-son kind of dynamic. And to me, it's like it was just hard to watch that with a real emotional investment. I don't know if it was because of the real time or just because there's so little room to set up that kind of relationship when 90% of the movie is fist fights and running. But for a genre, it's very good, and it has a very distinctive kind of camera work quality that stuck out.
And Nick, what about you?
I'm sort of on the same page. I liked everything but the screenplay, which is obviously kind of an issue. In terms of direction, I thought Jardine did some amazing work here. There's like these tracking shots that just keep going and going, and the camera is always moving, but it's not in the irritating Tony Scott style where there's no need for a camera to be doing what it's doing on screen. It all feels germane to the action. And I also was just kind of impressed by how you get the idea that this club isn't actually that big, but I like how they utilize every single inch of it and everything kind of comes into play, whether it be the kitchen or the gender-associated bathrooms or the back of the club. That was all very impressive, but I do think that the movie has a lot of lulls to it. Because they kind of tried to establish this. There's this sort of attempt at pathos with the father-son relationship, but that just didn't work for me at all. because it was, it's like what Danny said, when it's set in such a short amount of time, there's this temporal limit on what you can actually do. You don't have a lot of time to develop these relationships. So you kind of just get these quick scenes of these character interactions, and then they kind of expect you to have an emotional reaction to it. But I think the movie can't really pull it off. And in addition to that, basically whenever there wasn't, in the second half, whenever somebody wasn't engaged in physical combat, I just found it to kind of drag along a bit. So I did like the film, but I do think that it is, it just could have been tightened, which is weird to say about a movie that's 103 minutes, but yeah.
So I think of the three of us, I'm probably the one who, judging by what you two have said, liked this movie the most. I agree with everything you said about characterization. This is kind of a similar vein to what happened in The Raid. You kind of get like a 2-minute establishing shot that just kind of cues you in on who everyone is and how they relate to each other. And that's supposed to be enough. And yeah, I mean, the father-son thing, it worked for me. Insofar as I would hope that a father would care about his son enough to do this, but they never felt like anything beyond just father and son. You know, I wasn't thinking about, you know, their rich history together and all the different ways that perhaps the father had let his son down. I mean, there's not a lot of depth to it.
The kid's kind of a shithead too, which doesn't help.
Wait. Okay, wait. No, let's go into that.
I'm mostly joking.
I was about to say, the kid, for me, one of the better things about this movie is the fact that the kid wasn't the kind of hapless loser that a lot of kids are in films like this. Like, I guess like the most germane analog would be Taken. You know, that girl pretty much deserved to get taken. She did a lot of stupid things. And and I thought that the fact that this kid literally just sat there and shut the hell up, you know, was probably the best thing that could have been hoped for him.
I'm mostly joking, but what I mean is that it's just that he's very, there's not much to him when you're actually watching the film. It's kind of like he hates his dad and, you know, he wants to be with his mom. And it's just sort of, it's all very familiar and it's all very simple.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, they set up this antagonistic relationship between them so that there can be kind of an emotional payoff when the son realizes that his father is just beating the crap out of an entire nightclub to get him back. And yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, I understand, I get it. We need a reason to be here.
I just wish they had done more with him to make him a slightly more compelling character to actually retrieve, is all.
Well, I mean, he's his son. I mean, he doesn't have to be like a gifted piano prodigy.
But he's not my son. I'm just watching the film. And I suppose that just when I was watching it, I kind of didn't care about the kid at all. He was just kind of some 13-year-old brat.
Yeah,
that's all he was to me.
I understand that, because I wasn't engaged in this film in the way like, oh no, that poor child, I'm so concerned about this father and his son. I was just kind of engaged in a way like, how the hell is this man going to, like, one of my favorite types of films is the Murphy's Law film, where it's like anything can and will go wrong. And this movie, it feels as though they sat down and said, let's figure out the plot and then let's figure out every way that it can go wrong. And then instead of having like a session where they cut some of that stuff out, they just kept it all in. And I felt like that was really working in the film's favor, because a lot of times in a movie like this, you'll kind of get this sense of drag where, you know, it's like, okay, he should have been able to fix this by now. But the problem is, in this film, every time he fixes one thing, something else goes horribly wrong somewhere else. And
that almost gives it a kind of comedic, quasi-comedic quality, just in the sense that like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. Oh, and something worse happened. And then it's like, nothing possibly worse can happen than what just happened. And then they top it, and they top it, and they top it. And it's kind of almost funny in a way.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was done on purpose, but that's one of the things that I loved so much about it. The nightclub itself becomes kind of a character in this film, because you get to know the different sections. There's like the big kind of dance hall, and then there's the smoky backroom pool hall, and then there's the upper deck where it's really quiet and everything is really high class, and then there's the kitchen. And there are just kind of these running gags where he'll go into the kitchen and these two cooks will just give him the eye, like, why are you back here? Like, what are you doing here again? Like, you're in the kitchen for the fifth time, like, get out of here. And then he constantly runs into people in the pool hall, and it's always like right when they're about to make a shot. And things like that, you know, it kind of broke up the tension, and it also just gave you this really palpable sense of, you know, this is a continuous night. This is stuff that's still going wrong. And I really liked that about the film. I also like the fact that the action wasn't hyper-stylized. And I know that's kind of a weird thing to praise, but, I mean, the film starts off and the main character is grievously wounded, and he just kind of shoulders through it the whole night. And, you know, you get this sense that, like, by the end, he's not even really able to fight anymore. There are moments when it seems like he's about to get into a fight, and then he just kind of sighs, and he's like, okay, here we go again. One more thing I have to do to get the hell out of this nightclub with my son alive. Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't really heard much about this film, so I went into it kind of blind. I knew vaguely, you know, okay, it's like Die Hard or Taken. It's in a nightclub. It's obviously one night. And I was actually really surprised at how much I enjoyed it. And I tried to explain it to someone, and it was next to impossible. Because it was like, oh yeah, a drug deal goes wrong. And then he's trying to get his son back because of that. And then this goes wrong. And like, I had only explained the first 20 minutes of the film, and I already felt like I had to give away like 20 double crosses.
Yeah.
Which, again, was something that I really liked. Because luckily, even though it does have that level of problematic intensity, it's never really convoluted, which is something that I appreciated about the script. It's not...
Yeah, it's not exactly The Big Sleep we're talking about here.
I can't think of many things, actually, that I could dress this film down about. Like I said, you know, the comedy was good, the action was good, as long as the comedy was purposeful, and I feel like it was, because the film felt so meticulously crafted that I feel like they knew what they were doing. Like, there would be no reason to put those reaction shots from the chefs in.
Or there's the scene where he has to kind of the last minute throw down the stairs.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, like that felt very intentional, how there's sort of like this music cue that's supposed to be like, oh no, he's behind you, and then he just kind of disposes of him in 2 seconds.
Yeah. And that's another thing, like I said, you know, there's this kind of weariness to this character, Vincent. You know, he begins the day, and he's kind of, you know, he's not in the best place. You know, his son hates him, but he's bouncy. And then by the end, you can just kind of tell that this guy has had the crap beaten out of him. And it's a very John McClane type of thing. You know, like, he's still raring to go, and he's still willing to go the distance, but you can tell that he is really not having a good time with this. The only problem is that, like, because this movie is kind of so straightforward, and because there are so many twists and turns, there's not a lot that can be said about it in a general sense, I feel, without getting into spoilers. Unless either of you have something to add before, I think we can jump into spoilers and kind of tackle the plot and see what we thought of that.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Good. It is time for spoilers. So if you haven't seen this film, obviously it's out on Amazon Prime, it's out on iTunes, it's out on video on demand on most cable and satellite providers. I say it's only 103 minutes long. There's subtitles, but you know, get over it. It's really good. You should
see.
Oh
no.
Run from the subtitles. There is like a couple of lines of dialogue in English, so you know, you can hang your hat on that.
Oh, thank God.
But yeah, I say go see it. So yeah, time to get into spoilers. We were talking about the convoluted plot. Or, you know, complicated but not convoluted. There's a lot of double crosses going on. Did anyone have trouble following anything?
I was kind of expecting to, but then it turned out to be a little bit more, like, less complicated than I thought it was. One of the things is, I kind of saw a similar French movie last year called Point Blank, which was also this real-time kind of man on the run, people after him. And it's just like, once the double crosses start to kick in, it's hard for me to kind of just really have any reaction to them, because it's like, oh, okay, for one scene, I thought he was a good guy. Now he's a bad guy. Like, that's interesting, I guess. Like, I don't know. It's and especially at the end when there's kind of a more major double cross, and it seems to want to have this impact that it didn't really have for me, outside of a kind of just a campy sense, I guess, because the scene goes to really crazy places. But yeah, that's just one of the other things I would say was a slight drawback, but I didn't find it confusing.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I wasn't confused, and the double crosses and everything kept mounting, and I don't feel like I got a huge visceral, oh my god, surprised impact. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure I was supposed to, because like I said, this movie operates so purely on Murphy's Law, where everything goes wrong, that I was more interested in how everything was going to resolve itself than what the actual truth was. It's kind of like if you have a Rubik's Cube and you're trying to fix it, you know, you don't really care about what turns you have to make. All you care about is finally seeing all those colors on one side. died. So I just wanted to know how in the name of God this man was going to be able to come out of this night, both alive and with his son and without being arrested. And I think that the movie succeeded insofar as that. It does have, I hate to say this, the European ending where, you know, you can't just have the guy walking off and, like, you know, staggering a little bit but still being okay. Like, they rush him into a hospital and then you're just kind of on the son's face and then it cuts to black.
Yeah, the ending was a little bit, I felt like it was forced ambiguity, kind of. I thought it actually really earned, like, the happy ending.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
There's also kind of a loose thread, too. You talk about the scene that goes to some crazy places. That's never resolved. And just what happens in that scenario. There's really no reason to have left us with that thread unless they're planning a sequel or something. I was surprised that it ended where it did.
Well, for the scene, I think that we're talking about the crazy scene. We're talking about the scene in the car, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so the scene in question, basically a dirty cop kills three people in a car, one of whom is the drug dealer at the center of all this, and then he plants the gun on the drug dealer, crashes the car, and tries to set himself up as, like, the lone survivor of a last-ditch attempt by the drug dealer to get out scot-free, only to discover that one of the cops that he shot was not dead. I felt that that wrapped things up pretty decently, because the woman who survived, it already became pretty clear that she had put all the pieces together, and she knew that he was rotten, and she knew that Vincent was telling the truth about all the stuff that was going on. Again, I laugh just because I can't. It's so difficult to explain this movie in a concise way. Brevity escapes you. But yeah, when she claws her way out of that car and looks at him and he just kind of deflates against the wall, I feel like that was just kind of setting up that, you know, she's alive, she knows what happened, and he knows that she knows, and so he's just kind of given up because he can't handle this anymore. I mean, he was dropped down a stairwell. The man's capacity to keep fighting has got to be at least slightly diminished by that.
And he went through the kitchen stain.
Oh god, yeah. Oh man. I mean, this movie, the fact that anyone is still standing up at the end of it is just completely, completely insane. But again, that was one of those things that I kind of liked about it. I like the fact in this film that we begin with just this random drug heist and you have no idea who anyone is. And then slowly but surely you parse out all the pieces of information. I thought that the movie actually modulated the way that it gave out information very well, at least with regards to the main character, because you go through a fair amount of this movie thinking that he's just a dirty cop before, you know, he finally, in a really strange point of exposition, while he's trying to break someone's arm, explains to them that he's undercover. And while I think that that was kind of an easy out for making him a more sympathetic character, it was kind of unnecessary. It was another complication, but I liked it. Did anyone have problems with the way that this movie dribbled out information? Did you feel like it could have been a little more forthcoming and still have kept that sense of kind of manic energy?
I thought there could have been a little more clarity with the female cop, just in the sense that you sort of, the way the plot leads you along, it's almost as if she's a corrupt cop who's trying to get the cocaine herself for her own nefarious reasons, but that's not the case at all. And I just thought that there could have been a little more clarity there. It kind of throws you into that element. And I think the problem is that there's already so much going on, and you're focusing on the main character's own task, that when you introduce this separate element, it's kind of hard to put all your focus on it.
Yeah, I can get behind that, because I was uncertain of who she was at first. She felt like a saboteur. But again, this is when I still was kind of unclear as to exactly how he played into everything.
Yeah, in terms of the main character, I kind of liked how they kept it uncertain for a while. Like you said, I don't know if it had much purpose beyond just stretching the intrigue, but I thought it worked fine.
Yeah, the good thing about this movie, one of the things that I really appreciate about it, was the kind of mystery without being mysterious. A lot of movies like this will really push the ambiguity. You know, you'll have people saying, like, you know, you're in too deep, you don't even know what side you're on anymore. And in this movie, there wasn't that. It was just you're watching this guy and trying to see what he's doing to kind of parse it out for yourself. So the mystery is there, but it's not really played up. The other thing that I really liked is because this guy isn't known to us, you know, we know he has a son, which is obviously supposed to make us feel sympathy towards him, but that's kind of cheap. So the only thing you have to go on in terms of getting on his side is the fact that he seems like a very capable human being, and you really want to see if he's just able to MacGyver himself out of this situation. You know, good or bad, there were points when I was like, this guy is so clever, I just want to see how he can figure out how to make, you know, the best out of this terrible moment that's happening.
I love the flower
scene. Yeah, I was going to say, specifically the flower, because at first you're like, how the, this isn't going to work. Obviously, the people are going to know it's flower, and then he, you know, messes up the zipper, and then he, you know, tells them he's a cop, and he's telling them the cops are everywhere, and then he has the champagne sent up, and it's like, this guy is awesome. I mean, like, just purely based on his ability to, you know, think up things like that on the fly, I really wanted to see him succeed.
Just in terms of moments of sympathy, there's like one scene where he's stitching up his wound, and he kind of, like, halfway through stitching it up, he just kind of breaks down and starts sobbing.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of a good moment, because I was, while the scene was starting, I was just thinking, oh, okay, is this going to be another scene of a guy just watching someone tape up his wound? And then when he started kind of sobbing and breaking down, I thought it was a good kind of pause from the action, and I thought it worked.
Yeah, it did really start to humanize him.
It's completely believable. It's completely believable for, you know, considering everything that's already happened.
Oh, no, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it is one of those things, you know, you don't want to see him just, like, in a moment of quietude, breaking down and crying, like, oh, God, my son. But the fact that it was tied in with the physical pain then kind of led to a shattering of his facade and allowed him to kind of grieve for a moment. Yeah, that was really, I really liked that. And I thought that was a great moment for the character and the actor and the screenplay. It was able to show a lot in a single frame, and I really liked it. And I feel like the movie's comprised of a lot of moments that may not reach that same height, but definitely approach it, you know, close enough that you can really appreciate it. Like I said, you know, just looking back on this film, there's not a lot that I could really criticize it for. It doesn't employ, as you said, the shaky cam. You know, it's energetic without being frenetic.
Or when it does employ it, it feels necessary. It feels natural and not just purely a design choice.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't the film Unstoppable, where, you know, two people are standing on a train in the conductor's, like, cabin, and the camera's going freaking nuts. There are moments where you get kind of the like, camera harness to the chest, like, looking up at the character and things like that. But they make sense. And I think that this is a movie where a lot of things make sense. And so you're never drawn out of the film by having to just kind of say to yourself, oh, this is happening now. Like, it makes absolute sense that these things are happening. And it's weird that this is something that I appreciate in a film, but we've come to a place, I feel, where a lot of filmmakers do tricks just for the purpose of showing that they can. And so it's really nice to see Chardin take the time to actually kind of think to himself, like, what makes sense here? What's not only going to look good, but also serve my story? I don't know. I just keep thinking about things that happen in this movie and laughing to myself. The thing about this film is, because it takes place in a single night, and because it takes place in a single place, there are so many little cues that happen, and so many sort of nuances within the world, that it's really hard to discuss it without going through frame by frame. It moves at such a rapid pace. I don't even feel like, at certain points in this film, there are set pieces that you can even draw out. You know, we can talk about him in the stairs patching himself up. We can talk about him in the stairs fighting with a crooked cop. And we can talk about, you know, certain moments like that. But on the whole, it's not a movie that really lives or dies by scenes. It's a single, you know, rushing forward narrative moment. And as great as that is to view, it makes it really difficult to discuss, I feel.
Yeah, I think one scene that kind of stuck out for me is, we mentioned it briefly, where he's interrogating the female cop. And for me, I don't know if it was just me, but it had this really weird sexual kind of aggressiveness to it. Did either of you get that?
I didn't, and now I feel bad that I didn't pick up on that.
Okay. No, it just, like, I guess the reason it was interesting to me is because we know that obviously sex is the last thing on this guy's mind. Not only because his son's kidnapped, but we know previously he has this weird interaction with this girl at the club that he kind of uses to stay undercover. And then they're finally alone for one moment, and she tries to kiss him, and he's just kind of, like, not paying her any attention. He's just kind of looking around, tracking the drug dealers. And this scene where he's interrogating this cop, I don't know, I guess I won't go on if I was the only one who...
Well, no, yeah, actually, I feel bad because now I'm worried people will think you see some sexual connection between threatening to break a woman's arm, but I don't want that idea perpetuated.
I got the same kind of sense from it, actually. So you're not alone there. There was... Okay. I think that it was one of those moments in a movie where you think to yourself, just kiss her already, man.
Yeah, or something like that. It was just, I'll just stop, I guess.
I was just thinking that looked very painful. I couldn't, I don't know.
Very painful, yeah.
I think it was more the moments leading up to almost breaking the arm, more than the almost breaking the arm part, though it did continue through that. I do, since you brought it up, I did love the... Again, not so much a scene, but the section of the film that involved him trailing around this woman who he sees her in a lavatory when a guy is trying to, like, not really force himself on her, but is trying to aggressively persuade her towards something. And so this guy, Vincent, our main man, he at this point is like, all right, I'll do this. And he basically kicks the crap out of the guy, you know, steals his jacket, throws his own jacket on him as a means of disguise, and then just, like, pulls the girl along. He's like, hey, come on. And then uses her as, like, a kissing shield against the
world. He's so resourceful.
Yeah, like, he just looks around. He's like, what do I need? And then the girl is so into it. Like, she's perfectly fine with this. This man just brutally assaulted someone. He's taking her with him. And I kept expecting her to, like, run away screaming and maybe serve as some kind of distraction. But instead, she seems totally all right with the idea of being like, yeah, all right, I'll ride this out. I'll see where this goes. He can't be worse than the other guy. And then, like you said, that moment in the elevator when she's trying to kiss him in earnest and he just keeps kind of pulling away. And he's just like, look, I've got a thing to do. Can you stop it?
Yeah,
you also figure that's the last moment she would ever be into, like, some sort of intimate contact after what just happened.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, there's a lot of drugs circling around this club, so we can't begin to speculate what might be going on with her. It is kind of funny, though, that even after he's told her to, like, stop and, like, you know, leave him alone and she's free, she keeps kind of following him for a little while, which I kept expecting to come back in some way, and it doesn't. And I'm almost kind of glad it did, because that would have given this weird Deus Ex Machina to a film that basically just goes along on pure chance. But yeah, it was so weird that they had these moments with these women that were just, it's really hard to define, because usually in a movie like this, like, the girl is either, you know, the kick-ass bad guys, like, martial arts chick, or she's the damsel in distress who gets, like, one lucky shot off at the end to finish off the bad guy. And in this film, you know, there's the weird, you know, human shield who's completely all right with it, and I think, you know, at the end was kind of upset that it was over. And then you have the, I guess, nebulously characterized female cop. Again, it was something that I kind of appreciated at the time, and I still appreciate it now, just that they weren't, you know, trying to build him up a romance in this one night, and they actually kind of hinted towards it and then completely rejected it, so that, you know, the audience is aware that they did it on purpose. Like, we're not gonna have this guy be completely fixed by the end of the night. You know, he's not gonna fix his relationship with his wife. He's not gonna find new love. He just needs to get his damn son back. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that, you know, the plot is very simple, and there's not a point at which it kind of evolves into something else. Because there was a while where I was thinking, this man's going to try to find the drugs, he's going to bring down the entire cartel. But the second that he gets his son, he slaps a pair of handcuffs on them to keep, like, to make sure that they don't get separated again. And he's just like, we're running now, let's go. And he doesn't care. Like, he just gets the hell out of there. And he makes a phone call that will, like, tip off everyone else. But I like the drive, the singular, you know, just... I just want my kid back.
It also felt like a very real moment, too. It seemed like something a cop actually would do.
Yeah, exactly.
In that scenario. So
like I said, little things like that, the broader narrative strokes I really liked. I would have to say that I would recommend this film to literally everyone I know. It's not a masterpiece. It's not perfect, but I don't think it really tries to be. And that's good with me. I just really appreciated this. It's a very solid film. So that's my final recommendation. See it. Holy God, see it.
Yeah,
and I'll watch it again with you, because I really enjoyed my time with this film.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd feel very comfortable recommending it.
Yeah, absolutely, as would I. It's definitely worth your $10 on iTunes.
I mean, if you rent it, I think it's only $7. So get out there, see this film. So now that we've wrapped up our discussion of the film Sleepless Night, which, again, watch it. It's pretty good. It's time to give our just look forward to the DVDs and wide releases that are coming out in the week ahead, so we can give you an idea of what you should be doing with your time in the cinematic sphere. So yeah, I mean, I guess we should just say Avengers is coming out.
The Avengers.
So yeah, I mean, obviously that's the big one. There's also the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. That's Unlimited. There's a film apparently titled LOL.
With Miley Cyrus.
With Miley Cyrus. I'm sure that that will give the Avengers a run for its money. It's good counter-programming. Yeah, I mean, is anyone particularly looking forward to anything for any reason?
Well, people who have seen the Avengers say it's a lot of fun. So, I mean, that's basically what I expect from that movie. So I'm looking forward to seeing it next week. You know, it'll be good to go back to the theater.
I feel like I'm looking forward to the Avengers because I'm not particularly looking forward to it in the sense that I haven't really been following the trailers or anything, and I don't have much kind of expectations, I guess, because I just don't have a lot of vested interest in that franchise. So
yeah,
I think
I'm kind of the same way.
I think I might be in a good spot in a way.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I don't particularly care for the Marvel properties. Iron Man 1 was fun. That's about it. I enjoyed Captain America, but I only enjoyed it in so much as it was kind of like an Indiana Jones-esque film, and The Avengers definitely does not look like it's going to follow that, so I feel like the tone that I appreciated so much is going to be gone.
Yeah,
I'm a little
depressed
about that.
The first Iron Man is the only one that I've like really revisited because I find that film very enjoyable, but after that, I think I've liked them all to certain degrees, but I haven't had any desire to go back. So one of the things I'm looking forward to about the Avengers is that they're kind of changing up a certain formula that's been established. I think that'll help it feel a little more fresh, even though it's, you know, four characters you've seen in their own movies.
Yeah, the thing I'm looking forward to most about the Avengers is Hawkeye, because ever since I was a child, I've had an obsession with archers, stemming back to my love of Errol Flynn playing Robin Hood. So I'm just kind of interested to see how the heck they're going to fit that into a larger superhero narrative.
Yeah, I have no idea who he is, so I'm just
kidding. I mean, yeah, I didn't know about him at all until, like, I saw a midnight screening of Thor, and the entire theater flipped out when this guy picks up a bow. I was like, why? That's not a good weapon. Why would you pick that up? This guy's a god.
Yeah, I just remember my brother whispered to me, is that the guy from the Hurt Locker? And so that was kind of, that's my only real connection with him. I like Jeremy Renner, so
yeah, I like
yeah, Jeremy
he has that
Renner's
much
awesome.
For him.
I think now that I've thought about that, it actually would be great if this were a crossover with the Hurt Locker. Because, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. is a governmental thing. They could draw from the military.
So that's where he was walking to at the end?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Spoilers for a movie that won Best Picture 2 years ago. But
I mean, that's barely a spoiler. I guess it's kind of a spoiler.
He doesn't die.
I mean,
that much.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I don't view things like that as a spoiler, but whatever. So the Avengers is coming out. I saw one trailer and thought it looked underwhelming. I know that's an unpopular opinion, but I don't care.
A lot of people who said that, though, who have actually seen the movie, say that, you know, the trailers are not indicative of the final thing. They kind of held a lot back.
Yeah, which is good. So. I'll appreciate that because a lot of the other Marvel movies kind of gave away a lot of their big moments in the trailers. So I'm looking forward to being surprised. So yeah, The Avengers this Friday. I'm sure that you don't need us to tell you to go see it, but we're telling you anyway. Also on DVD and Blu-ray on May 1st, this coming Tuesday, I'm actually probably going to go out and buy Haywire, the film by Steven Soderbergh. Did either of you see this film?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw Haywire.
Yeah. I liked it enough when I was watching it. I thought it was pretty good. Obviously, I loved the style. I loved the, you know, more realistic-ish fight scenes. And then for some reason, about a month ago, I found myself thinking about it, and I really wanted to see it again. And ever since that moment, it's just kind of been building in my brain. So I'm going to go out and buy it because I have no idea why.
Yeah, I like that movie very much.
So if you can't wait to see The Avengers to get your action fix, go get Haywire. It's a slick, stylish, jazz-infused, international spy romp. And, you know, Friday's The Avengers, so definitely go see that. Speaking of which, our next episode, we will be talking about The Avengers. So look forward to our thoughts on that. Since you now know what our expectations were, you'll be able to judge them and see how we go into a movie and come out.
And yell us, and you can also yell at us if we don't like the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we look forward to any kind of yelling at us. Speaking of which, if you would like to yell at us, you can yell at us at the following email address, podcast@thefilmstage.com. Any comments, anything about our opening discussion about 48 frames per second and digital projection, any thoughts on Sleepless Night? And yeah, I mean, next week when we talk about The Avengers again, you can talk to us about that as well. That's about it for today. Again, I'm your host, Brian Rowan. Danny, Nick, why don't you tell us where we can find more of your work on the internet?
You can find my work at the Film Stage, obviously. I also maintain a personal blog at thekingbulletin.com and on twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
You can find all my writings at thefilmstage.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me at thefilmstage.com. You can also find me at my personal blog, dearfilm.net. And you can follow me on Twitter if you prefer. And I am twitter.com/BrianJRowan. That's Brian with an I. And that is it for today. So thank you very much again. And we look forward to seeing you, or for you to hear us, next week when we discuss The Avengers.